The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. This is the July issue. I'm sorry, it's the June issue. I'll also be reading from the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is an interesting article about pharmacogenomics. That's pharmacogenomics. And it comes to us from a doctorate of pharmacy named Adriana Kesick. Who is this treatment for? Over the years, you'll learn which medications work for you, as well as those that bring significant side effects or that don't seem to make a difference in your symptoms. This knowledge is typically gained through trial and sometimes expensive or painful error. What if there was an easier way? That's where pharmacogenomics, also known as pharmacogenetics or PGX, comes in. It aims to predict how you will react to a drug, combining the sciences of pharmacology and genetics. The hope is that this field will help people find which medications and doses are best for them. Ideally, this will allow people to skip ineffective options and sidestep some side effects. It's never a good day when a patient tells me that the side effects of a drug are worse than the disease symptoms, says Adriana Kesick, PharmD, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic with expertise in pharmacogenomics. Here, Dr. Kesick answers common questions about pharmacogenomics. What is pharmacogenomics? Each person has more than 20,000 genes. Genes give instructions to create proteins that serve many functions, including functions that affect how the body processes medications. For example, the CYP2D6 gene makes the CYP2D6 enzyme that breaks down some commonly used drugs like antidepressants and pain medications. Over 99% of genes are identical among all people, but that 1% difference is what makes each person unique. It also means that a drug can affect each person differently. PGX, or pharmacogenomics, studies these variations and their impact on drug metabolism and effectiveness. For example, if you metabolize certain medications slowly, they remain in your body longer, potentially building up and leading to significant side effects. A low dose or alternative drug may be a better fit. If you metabolize certain medications rapidly, they may be cleared from your body before you get adequate symptom relief or effect. So a higher dose, more frequent dosing, or an alternative drug may be a better fit. With a simple swab or blood draw, scientists can look at genes associated with drug responses to help predict how you may react to certain drugs. There are currently over 200 drugs with pharmacogenomic information in their labels. Why is it so important? Some drugs, even when taken correctly, are not a good fit for some people. Negative effects can include severe or intolerable side effects. Some people experience side effects so severe that they have to stop taking a drug. Additionally, drugs were historically tested primarily on men, and women have biologic differences that may affect how a drug is metabolized, distributed, and eliminated from the body. This can make women more susceptible to increased drug levels in their bodies, which is linked to more side effects. Drugs not working as well. Some people may report limited benefits. Death. Some estimates find that drug reactions may be the fourth leading cause of death in the United States, with over 100,000 deaths in 1 year. Pharmacogenomics aims to reduce the risk of bad reactions by helping predict how people will respond to a drug even before they take it. Consider these examples. Testing HLA genes can identify if you're at risk of drug hypersensitivity or severe skin reactions to drugs like the HIV drug Abacavir, also known as Xiagen, and the anti-seizure and bipolar disorder medication carbamazepine, also called Carbitrol or Tegretol. Testing the CYP2D6 gene can help predict whether the pain relievers tramadol and codeine and the breast cancer drug tamoxifen or Soltamox may work for you or whether they might produce major side effects. Testing the CYP2C19 gene can help predict whether the antidepressant citalopram or Celexa, the blood-thinning medication clopidogrel or Plavix, and the acid-reducing medication omeprazole or Prilosec may work for you or whether they may produce intolerable side effects. Most testing requires saliva or blood. If you elect saliva or cheek swab testing, be sure to avoid putting anything in your mouth, including liquids, foods, gum, medication, or any form of tobacco, for 30 minutes before the swab. That doesn't apply when giving a blood sample. Once the results are back, you may meet with a pharmacist or a doctor trained in pharmacogenomics to help interpret the results. Insurance companies have gotten better about covering pharmacogenomics, but it's still a good idea to check your insurance coverage before testing. Some people hesitate to get testing for fear of discrimination. But unlike some other genetic tests, pharmacogenomics focuses on medication responses, not disease risk. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act prevents discrimination by most health insurers and employers. It does not apply to life insurance, long-term care insurance, or disability insurance. Now, once again in the June 2023 issue of the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, here's an article called Visceral Fat, Nothing to Laugh About. Limbs Like Willows, A Belly Like a Pillow. The body type described above, lithe in the arms and legs but thick in the trunk, may inspire lighthearted comparisons to Santa Claus or Homer Simpson. Lurking within that excess belly fat, known as visceral fat, are potentially serious health risks. Where fat is stored in the body determines overall health risk. It's like real estate in that sense. It comes down to location, location, location. Fat in the belly area around your internal organs, which often leads to having an apple-shaped midsection, is the most dangerous type of fat in terms of your health and longevity. Visceral fat is a particular concern for older adults because it may not be well recognized as a health risk. Your weight is determined in part by your age, how many calories you consume, and how many calories you burn through daily activity. More eating and less moving can lead to carrying excess weight, including belly fat. Hormones, genetics, and even medications play a role in weight. Also, muscle mass will typically diminish with age while fat increases. Loss of muscle mass also decreases the rate at which your body uses calories, which can make it more challenging to maintain a healthy weight. According to the 2020 through 2025 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, Men in their 50s need about 200 fewer calories daily than they do in their 30s due to this muscle loss. Many women also notice an increase in belly fat as they get older, even if they aren't gaining weight. This is related to decreased estrogen, as sex hormones influence where fat is distributed in the body. Determining your weight category, healthy, overweight, or obese, usually involves measuring your weight and comparing with your height. The easiest way to do this is by calculating your body mass index. The body mass index is often used as a screening tool, although it's not always accurate in estimating body composition, particularly for older adults and elite athletes. Excess visceral fat, even in people with a healthy BMI, is linked to elevated blood sugar, high blood pressure, undesirable cholesterol, a fatty liver, and inflammation throughout the body. These factors fuel the development of heart disease, liver disease, diabetes, and cancer, and increase your risk of premature death. Preliminary research also has associated high visceral fat content with more severe cases of COVID-19. In contrast, fat stored just under the skin, like in the hips, thighs, and buttocks, isn't as damaging, even if you are categorized as obese on the BMI scale. Measuring your waist circumference is an easy way to assess belly fat. While standing up, wrap a flexible measuring tape around your abdomen, just above your hip bones. Pull the tape measure until it's snug, but doesn't press into your skin. Make sure the tape measure is level all the way around. For women, a waist measurement of more than 35 inches indicates an unhealthy amount of belly fat and a greater risk of health problems. For men, a waist measurement of more than 40 inches indicates the same. A foundation of losing excess body fat is a healthy diet that includes an emphasis on portion control. Minimally processed plant foods like vegetables, whole grains, fruits, and nuts, and lean sources of protein. Limited or no high-calorie drinks, like soda or alcoholic beverages. Exercise and physical activity are particularly beneficial for losing belly fat and offsetting health risk. Exercise doesn't always directly help with weight loss. However, it improves body composition by increasing muscle mass and enhancing fat loss. Particularly belly fat when compared with healthier eating and calorie control. Try to incorporate at least 30 to 60 minutes of moderate intensity exercise on most days. Exercise has an optimal effect when you mix cardiovascular activities like walking or swimming with muscle strengthening like resistance training. Now I'm going to go on with the Harvard Health Letter. This is the issue of June 2023, and I'm going to start with this section called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony Komaroff, MD, who's the editor-in-chief of the Health Letter. And the question is, will artificial intelligence replace doctors? Everybody's talking about artificial intelligence and how it may replace people in various jobs. Will artificial intelligence replace my doctor? Not in my lifetime, unfortunately, says Dr. Komaroff. And the good news is that artificial intelligence has the potential to improve your doctor's decisions and thereby improve your health, if we're careful about how it is developed and used. Artificial intelligence is a mathematical process that tries to make sense out of massive amounts of information. So it requires two things: the ability to perform mathematical computations rapidly and huge amounts of information stored in electronic form, words, numbers, and pictures. When computers and AI were first developed in the 1950s, some visionaries described how they could theoretically help improve decisions about diagnosis and treatment. But computers then were not nearly fast enough to do the computations required. Even more important, almost none of the information that computers would have to analyze was stored in electronic form. It was all on paper. Doctors' notes about patients' symptoms and physical exam were written on paper. Test results were written on paper and pasted in a patient's paper medical record. As computers got better, they started to relieve doctors and other health professionals from some tedious tasks, like helping to analyze images, electrocardiograms, blood samples, x-rays, and pap smears. Today, computers are literally millions of times more powerful than when they were first developed. Huge amounts of medical information now is in electronic form. Medical records of millions of people, the results of medical research, and the growing knowledge about how the body works. That makes feasible the use of AI in medicine. Already, computers and AI have made powerful medical research breakthroughs, like predicting the shape of most human proteins. In the future, I predict that computers and AI will listen to conversations between doctor and patient and then suggest tests or treatments that doctors should consider, highlight possible diagnoses based on the patient's symptoms after comparing that patient's symptoms to those of millions of other people with various diseases, and draft a note for the medical record so the doctor doesn't have to spend time typing in a computer keyboard and can spend more time with the patient. All this will not happen immediately or without missteps. Doctors and computer scientists will need to carefully evaluate and guide the development of new AI tools in medicine. If the suggestions AI provides to doctors prove to be inaccurate or incomplete, that help will be rejected. And if AI then does not get better and fast, it will lose credibility. Powerful technologies can be powerful forces for good and for mischief. Now, here's another article from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's called Better Together, the Many Benefits of Walking with Friends. Walking with others has a host of health perks and helps you stay motivated. There's an old saying that if you want to get fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. One good example is exercising, especially brisk walking, the kind that gives your heart and lungs a workout and boosts overall health. The activity is easy to do with family and friends, and the team approach can pay off in many ways. Going for a brisk walk with one or more friends is a form of socializing, which is essential for good health. Socializing helps stave off isolation and loneliness, which are associated with heart disease, diabetes, arthritis, depression, chronic stress, and premature death. Socializing also helps exercise the brain, which protects your thinking skills. When you socialize, your brain interprets people's facial expressions, speech, emotions, and body language, and then powers your reactions, turning your thoughts into words, facial expressions, and body movements. That extra effort from socializing, even if you're unaware of it, promotes brain cell connections, which keep thinking and memory sharp. The physical work of a walk also stimulates the growth of new brain cells. So when you socialize while you walk, you get a double dose of brain health benefits. Have trouble sticking to an exercise regimen? You're not alone. Humans aren't designed to exercise. We're designed to conserve energy. We love to sit around. That's our nature, says Dr. Edward Phillips, associate professor of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Harvard Medical School and whole health medical director at VA Boston Healthcare System. You'll have better luck staying on a walking routine if you go with friends, primarily for two reasons. The first is accountability. Friends have expectations, and we tend not to want to let them down. We jump through hoops to be there for others. So if you agree to walk with a friend, you're more likely to do it, Dr. Phillips says. Also, there's motivation. When you walk with someone else, you challenge and encourage each other. Imagine that you hit a wall while walking, but other people around you are still going. That makes you realize that it's doable, and you keep walking, Dr. Phillips says. The other piece is that being with others is fun, and you might be more inclined to go for a brisk walk if you think about it as spending time with friends rather than a chore. You'll want to go. It's practical. Walking with a buddy is safer than walking alone. There are more eyes watching for hazards you may miss, and you'll be more visible to drivers when you walk in pairs or a group. Also, if you experience any kind of health problem while walking, or if you fall, a friend can take care of you and call for help, says Dr. Phillips. Having a person on hand who can help you is especially important if you have a chronic condition that can lead to sudden symptoms like heart disease, asthma, or a balance disorder. One caution, don't leave your phone at home and assume you'll use someone else's in an emergency. If that person is unable to speak and share the phone's passcode, you'll be out of luck. It's better if each person on the walk brings a fully charged phone. Make the most of your walk with friends by challenging and coaching each other. You can challenge yourselves by trying a different style of walking, like Nordic walking, which uses poles. Doing new things is fun, good for your thinking skills, and easier with a buddy. Or try improving your walking times. Note how long it usually takes to get from here to there. If it's 32 minutes, try to do it in 31 minutes or 30 minutes, Dr. Phillips says. To do a little coaching, Dr. Phillips suggests making a deal to keep each other in good walking form. Make sure all walkers are swinging their arms and keeping poles at a 45-degree angle. You can easily adjust your pace to stay in step with just one friend. But what if you're walking in a group? If you'd all like to walk at the same pace, use a metronome app and play it loudly on your phone, or clap your hands or beat a small drum. Take turns being the person who maintains the pace. Or if the group is comfortable with it, let the faster walkers get ahead. After a while, they can take a break and stretch while they wait for the others to catch up. Or the faster walkers can slow down by making their routines more intense. They can raise their arms up and down while walking, wear a weighted vest, or carry other people's water bottles. Have fun with it and enjoy the journey. You're not just there for exercise, you're there for camaraderie. The fact that it comes with health benefits is the icing on the cake. Now, I'm going to go on with some news briefs from the Harvard Health Letter of June 2023. And the first is, irregular sleep patterns is linked to arteriosclerosis. Go to sleep at 11 p.m. one night and 2 a.m. the next. You may want to rethink that pattern. A study published online February 15, 2023, by the Journal of the American Heart Association, suggests that sleep irregularity, night-to-night variation in sleep duration and timing, are linked to atherosclerosis, or plaque buildup in the arteries. Researchers from Harvard and other institutions asked a diverse group of more than 2,000 people, average age 69, without any known atherosclerosis, to wear sleep trackers and keep sleep diaries for 1 week. Participants also underwent assessments of artery plaque and one night of sleep testing. Scientists found that people with the most variation in sleep duration, more than 2 hours a night in a week, and sleep timing, more than 90 minutes in a week, were more likely to have atherosclerosis compared with people whose sleep was the most consistent. This is an observational study, and we can't make definitive conclusions about cause and effect. But we already know that other sleep problems, like interrupted sleep and poor sleep quality, are associated with cardiovascular disease. And there's also a brief section called blood pressure measurements vary widely at the doctor's office. About half the U.S. adults have high blood pressure, and only a quarter of them have it under control. Most people with high blood pressure don't monitor at home. They rely only on measurements taken at healthcare visits. But that's not going to give you an accurate picture, suggests a study from March 8, 2023, by Circulation. Researchers evaluated more than 7.7 million blood pressure measurements taken from more than 537,000 adults, average age 53, over more than 2 years. Each participant averaged 13 doctor visits during that time. Scientists found wide variation in blood pressure measurement from one visit to the next, especially in people with known high blood pressure. A person's blood pressure can change substantially from hour to hour. Researchers say that faulty equipment or imprecise techniques used to measure blood pressure at the doctor's office may also explain the variability. Wide variations in reading can make it hard to determine if blood pressure drugs are working or if someone should start taking medications. You should take your blood pressure at home regularly, 2 or 3 times per week. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.